The Radio Today program with Broadcast Bionics. Innovative solutions for creative radio people.
Hello, I'm Trevor Dan. We're back in roundtable mood for this week's Radio Today programme, courtesy of the lovely people at Jazz FM in central London. I'm joined by a stellar cast to discuss how local radio needs to be, when disappointed DJs do their last show, BBC Radio's pop-up stations, and some really great recommendations for your future listening pleasure. David Lloyd's here too with his radio moments. Stuart Clarkson has the latest news. But first, let's meet our panel.
I'm Brett Spencer. I'm editor for digital for the BBC Popular Music Networks.
Kelly Weil, head of Seven Digital Creative.
Phil Maguire, chief executive of the Prison Radio Association.
Welcome all. Let's start with you, Kelly, because you are the news. Seven Digital. Now, we know that is unique. We know it is above the title and smooth ops. Why have you brought all the companies together and under your aegis?
So just over 2 years ago, so the UBC Media Group, which unique smooth operations above the title were part of, we merged with this company called Seven Digital. And so Seven Digital Creative is basically bringing together all the teams that do any kind of creative work across the business into one team. That essentially is the three radio production brands and also our entertainment news team, who are providing news bulletins out into commercial radio, and also the Seven Digital in-house music team. Seven Digital still has a D2C offering, download to own music stores operating in 23 territories around the world. And so curation work, playlisting work is quite linked closely to what we do in radio production. So we're all now part of one group.
So I'm just interested in drilling down a little bit, because yeah, there used to be an argument that particularly the BBC would be more likely to trade with the big companies if you kept all your little discrete companies going, yeah, rather than being seen, yeah, to be a big behemoth. Why do you think that's changed?
Well, there are probably some really practical reasons why that's changed. At the moment, we're all talking about, for example, the way Radio 4 is changing its commissioning structure, moving towards batch commissioning. We all know it used to be the case where, well, there was a limit to how many programmes each individual company could put in any commissioning round. So let's keep the companies separate. That gives us more bites at the cherry. Whereas now one of, you know, not linking it specifically to Radio 4, but one of the reasons behind us deciding to be more clear about us being one big, robust team rather than three small ones is because we seem to be moving. That seems to be what the networks are telling us they want.
Let's just say for people who might not know what we're talking about here, that BBC Radio 4 particularly is looking at buying programmes, yeah, by the batch, you know, by the bucket load, rather, yeah, than a load of one-off single commissions. I guess that affects us all, doesn't it? Those of us who pitch programmes to the BBC, because we're all going to be thinking, ooh, we might get one or two, but we're not going to get 10 or 12 because the BBC will think we're too small, Phil.
Well, I run, with a lot of help, I run a small indie called PRI Productions, and I think the changes happening at the BBC are interesting, and I'm a bit of an optimist. I see it as an opportunity, and I've been to a couple of meetings run by Rick, who've been doing a brilliant job lobbying on behalf of the independent sector. Consultation meetings full of independent producers, many of whom, with all due respect, are sitting there moaning about these changes, and I suspect that they were the same people who used to sit around moaning about the status quo before it changed. We've got to compete now with the big boys like Seven Digital. Sorry, Kelly, big girls like Seven Digital. But I think we're hopeful. We want to get a couple of batches. We are building the case for PRA Productions having a really fantastic USP, which is what they're looking for. And we're coming up with lots of ideas to win batches.
This is a Radio 4 thing at the moment, Brett, and you're 2 and 6 Music and Radio 1. And I know you're part of the digital thing rather than the programme commissioning side. But is this just about saving money, do you think, from what you hear at the BBC?
Well, actually, I am going to be on the commissioning side in terms of commissioning digital content through what is now called the Radio Commissioning Framework. And it's about programmes going out from all networks, not just for Radio 4. And Radio 2 are putting out 7 programmes very, very shortly. And it's really an opportunity. It's an opportunity for in-house production and for the indie sector to compete for those programmes. And the outcome will be that we'll get the best ideas from both sides and provide value for money for the licence fee payer.
You must meet, though, people who inhabit the same corridors that you do at the BBC, who are members of staff, who say this is a rotten thing because the independent producers charge more, and it's going to mean that some of us in-house are going to lose our jobs.
I think it's about opportunity and about taking the opportunity that's there. And at the end of the day, it's about the listener, isn't it? And about the audience and making sure the audience get the best programme and the best value for money.
What's the secret, Kelly, to getting programmes on the BBC?
Oh, that's a good question. I think it's... obviously, each network has its own different set of criteria and different things that make things successful. I mean, it's increasingly about talent as well. I think, I don't know if the others would agree, but we've seen quite a big shift maybe over the last 10 years, especially with the music networks, where having big names, names that are household names, is increasingly becoming more important. But I think one of the things that we've learned over the past 5 years is also, as independent producers, really making sure that our programmes sound and feel like they belong on the network. So there's no, as a listener doesn't want to hear a programme coming on that sounds like it's on a different station to the programme before. And since Radcliffe and Marconi moved on to Six Music and we moved from Manchester to Salford, something I think we've really learned how to do is having a team of people in the building working alongside in-house production, which may change a little bit now moving forward with the Radio Commissioning Framework, but I think that's really key to it, understanding your network.
And some people might say, well, that means that the shows that the indies are making are the same as the ones that BBC in-house would make. That's clearly not true, is it, Phil?
No, it's not. The indies bring something different, don't they? They don't walk into those buildings every day. They don't sit next to the same people every day. They don't, I guess, potentially read the same newspapers every day. They operate in different spheres and are influenced differently, and hopefully that results in different ideas coming. Your question was about how do you get these programmes commissioned, and I think what Kelly said is right. It's got to be, or it should be at least, about the ideas. And I think it's about ideas and it's about relationships. And it's not just relationships with talent and knowing the audience and having a relationship with the audience, but it is about having a relationship with the commissioners, knowing the network, understanding the network. And increasingly, I think what particularly Radio 4 are telling us now is that it's about capacity as well. Can you demonstrate that your organisation, that your indie, can deliver what they're promising to deliver?
That's why the guys that we might describe as, you know, one man and his ewer are so worried, I guess, that they think, well, they'll all be squeezed out and all the work will go to the big boys.
And it is a concern, but what the BBC are saying, what Radio 4 are saying, is that there's going to be many more programmes available. We're going to be releasing them in batches, but there will be as many, if not more, individual programmes available to the smaller players thereafter.
OK, so when it comes to thinking about this kind of stuff in the future, Brett, do you think this is just the beginning of the BBC becoming more of a publisher and less of a manufacturer, less of a creative factory itself?
I think it's likely that in the next set of commissioning rounds there will be changes. But we need to recognise that in-house production at the BBC, you know, is an enormously healthy position with incredibly experienced and creative content makers that are making great shows and have been doing that for a long time. And they will get the opportunity to continue doing that, but now we'll mix it in with the very best ideas from the independent sector. I don't think the BBC will become a publisher in the way that you allude, but I think we'll have a much greater mix of content.
OK, this is the Radio Today monthly roundtable. We've got Phil Maguire here and Brett Spencer and Kelly Weil. And Brett, I'm going to come back to you because it's a big week in your life. It's the annual Radio 2 Country pop-up.
My wife, Connie Smith, says country music is the cry of the heart.
People who never listened to country music before fall in love with something and then they find other things that they love.
They'll all make you smile.
Welcome to BBC Radio 2 Country.
What's the rationale behind that? You're a business, the BBC, that's always telling us you're running out of money. What are you spending money on this for?
Well, we're not spending a lot of money on it. I do know that.
You do know that. Kelly was only telling me how much you're paying per programme.
Yes, absolutely. And this is really about getting Radio 2 listeners to consume our content on digital platforms and getting them to find more of the programmes they enjoy and the presenters they enjoy, but in places they wouldn't necessarily listen. So this is the third year we've done Radio 2 Country. It broadcasts on digital radio and it broadcasts online. We'll be broadcasting from the O2 for 3 days with the whole of the C2C Festival live, Country to Country Festival, some of the biggest names there. You'll hear all your favourite Radio 2 presenters. Joe Wiley's there and Simon Mayer will be on air and Steve Wright. And we've got a range of commissioned programmes. Colin Murray doing a programme on the relationship between country music and drink. Seven Digital have made us a programme. Do you want to tell us about that?
We have. It's a programme that Mark Radcliffe has presented for us, Hank Williams. Thanks, Hank.
Excellent. And this year we've Three got chords and the truth.
And this year we've got an hour of Chris Country, the digital radio station, which expanded a year ago and is doing very well. And Chris will be presenting some of the highlights of that station on Radio 2.
It's a thing you like to do, because your other annual pop-up is BBC Jazz, which you do in relationship with the guys here at Jazz FM. What's the point of that?
It's an opportunity for the BBC to work with commercial radio and show what commercial radio does, particularly around the genre space. And why not? It's a chance to show off what they do and to spread the love and promote the genre across the industry, but not just within the BBC.
In the genre space, Kelly.
There you go.
Can we think of some other things that might fill the genre space?
I think a folk music
DAB. Oh, really?
DAB
fancy
would be an
you thinking that.
Good idea. Well, you know, I come from originally Smooth Operations before we merged with UBC and then with Seven Digital, and that company was, you know, based on passion for folk music and country music with Nick Barraclough and John Lennard, the two founders. So genre space,
and
specialist music's very much at the heart of what we do.
Can I just say, of course, everybody's got an interesting story about how they got into radio. Yeah. Just briefly tell us yours.
Well, I grew up, my mum and dad met in a folk club. They were a duo performing when I was a kid. Spent a childhood being dragged around folk festivals against my will. Gradually got to like it. Followed my mum through the route into singing. Did that for a living till my mid-20s, and then realised I really loved singing, but I was probably always going to be skint, so better get a proper job. So I was very, very fortunate to go and work for Smooth Ops, who were making the folk show for Radio 2, to be doing a job working in the music that I love, that I'm passionate about, that I brought up on, and very fortunate to be still involved in it today.
What else, Phil, might go into the genre space?
Well, on the way to the studio, Trevor, I bumped into David Rodigan on the street.
Oh, how cool is that?
And
that doesn't happen in, let me think, Derby.
And David Rodigan, reggae legend, and I had a very brief conversation with him, saying to him, oh, look, there's this pop-up country thing going on at the moment. When are Radio 2 going to do Radio 2 reggae? The listenership would be fantastic and it would bring incredibly interesting and diverse audiences to Radio 2 in a way that perhaps country music doesn't.
I feel like everyone's pitching me in this room at the moment.
We're holding you to account.
We only decide on pop-ups one at a time, as it were, so that we haven't got any plan beyond this at the moment. You know, we've done different things. We've done jazz twice, we've done Eurovision, we've done Radio 250s. We're always looking for different opportunities to explore within pop-up spaces.
I think he's saying yes. Honestly.
Excellent.
I think, you know, have a word with David next time you see him in the street, Phil.
We'll take that as a formal commission.
As I say, there are no plans beyond country at the moment.
All right. Brett, you used to run a radio station, and, you know, we've all worked on programmes where our presenters have reached the end of the line. What do we think about presenters being allowed to say goodbye or not? And I asked this question with the background of Howard Bentham's remarks about how he's moving shows, and he hopes that David Prever will be able to manage his journey from St Albans to Oxford every day. A clear dig at the fact that the replacement presenter doesn't live locally like Howard himself does. Should we let people do their last show so they can say goodbye? It's always a risk, Phil, isn't it?
Well, on National Prison Radio, I wish we could, but many of our presenters, all of whom are prisoners, are shipped out at a moment's notice for various bureaucratic reasons, complicated reasons. So I wish we could give our presenters a chance to do a last show. But I just think that people being bitter on their final show, if you're angry with your boss, go and shout at your boss. Don't shout at the audience about what an idiot your boss is. It's all about ego, isn't it? If somebody goes on air and talks about how bitter they are that they've been moved somewhere else, you've still got a job, you're still doing the job you love, you're still doing radio. Just have a bit of grace and a bit of be polite and be decent and just go out nicely, surely.
I think one of the problems with it is it's the thing you get remembered for. So there are certain presenters, I won't name them, who if you mention to me, I immediately think about their last show or the blog they wrote when they left or the conversation they may have had on here about when they were leaving. And to be associated with that is not necessarily the thing you want to be best remembered for.
It is all about the discretion, isn't it, of the presenter. I mean, you've had one or two. Are we thinking of the same person as I look across the table?
we've had a few. I think it is. I agree with what Phil said. It's on air. Let's make it about the listener and about the relationship you've had with the listener. Most of the presenters I've been lucky enough to work with, if it's coming, whether it's their decision or not to come to the end of a show, they will be very grateful for the opportunity they've had to do it. Remember how lucky you've been to have had that job and thank the people you need to thank and then do anything else.
Well, that was the aspect of it that I found quite interesting. My own personal experience of this is of... When Matthew Bannister and I were running GLR, we had as our breakfast show host Nick Abbott. You may think that was a reckless booking, but he was quite good, actually. But Matthew decided that he had to go, and he told him on a Thursday evening and said, don't bother coming in tomorrow to do your last show. And then he asked me if I would do it. So I had to do the... he didn't ask me, he told me, because I was working for him. So I had to go on and try to explain to the listeners who were expecting Nick why he wasn't here. And I found that very uncomfortable.
As a programme director or as a producer who's worked with a presenter for a long time, you're going to have a pretty good idea of whether or not it's safe to let your presenter go and do a goodbye show, aren't you?
And I think as a manager, part of your job is to, I don't know, I guess to have the conversation and say this is an opportunity for you to do a really special programme, to give something to your listeners that you've given so much to over the months or the years and that you've got so much from. Why don't you make this a great programme? I mean, it's still a bit dangerous because you never know what's going to say, what they're going to say. Yeah.
We all remember Danny Baker's last show on BBC London. That will go down the history, I'm sure. And it won't be the only thing that Danny's remembered for, but for some of these guys, it will be the thing that they're remembered for, and that's not the thing you want.
Does it matter, and it's something that Howard is talking about in his remarks, does it matter that you live locally? There's a blog on the Radio Today site written by Stu Clarkson, who's normally at the news desk on this podcast, saying that in this day and age where everybody gets moved around a lot and if you've got school-aged kids, you can't possibly keep moving, it's inevitable that some folks will live 100 miles from the radio station where they're working. How important... I mean, when you were running, Three Counties Radio that you managed for a while, Brett, did you care whether somebody lived in Luton or Bedford?
I had a combination of presenters. I had presenters that lived in the Patch. I had presenters that lived in London. I had one that lived in Cambridge. The thing that did worry me was my London presenter driving to Luton every morning in the dark, in wintry conditions, etc. So while I wasn't necessarily worried that they didn't live in the place, I was worried about the effect on them of having that long commute. Now, if Dave is commuting from St Albans to Oxford every morning, that's a long drive. So that would be my concern as a station manager, rather than whether, you know, he's a great broadcaster. I'm sure he knows Oxford very well. The show will be terrific, I'm sure. But my concern was always about, you know, people commuting in long distances at 4 a.m.
Because that's the point that Stuart is making in his blog. He's saying it doesn't really matter where you live because you can soon pick up the vibe of the town where you're broadcasting. Do we all think that's true?
Well, I think that's true. I think if you're sitting in a radio station, you're talking about where you live and it's somewhere else, then clearly that's going to sound odd. But if you're talking about your surroundings, I don't think it makes a difference.
It depends on what the expectation of your audience is, doesn't it? Especially on local radio. I mean, I live in Sheffield and know that on BBC Sheffield, the two most popular presenters by some distance are Sheffield presenters. I do think it matters, but then you know, how many presenters would any station have? You can't expect them all to live locally. I suppose being local and living locally are two different things, aren't they? But I think there is an expectation that whoever's talking to you about your area
And they're also familiar things about where people's families live, if that makes sense. So if you've got a job with a radio station and it's for a year and your kids are in school and you live somewhere else, it's hard to uproot everybody. Mm. I'm always surprised how often football managers are working in the north but living in London, if that makes sense. So I think it's difficult to demand everybody lives where the station is.
And I think it's important that people have a connection with the patch and people love the patch. You know, you have to have that at least. But somebody from outside of the patch brings something different, surely. They can bring a perspective which, you know, we live in a smaller world. Mm. 30 years ago, perhaps it was crucial. Today, we're all on the internet. We're all connected with people all over the place. And we expect to interact with people from further afield. So maybe somebody from outside of the patch brings a different perspective to the patch.
Have we all entered the British Podcast Awards?
I've not, but I'm judging it. I'm one of the many judges.
There are a lot of judges, aren't there?
And what a great bunch of judges.
I'm also a judge. I understand they got twice as many entries as they were expecting.
That's very good.
So that's very positive news.
I'm not a judge. I haven't been asked this year. Oh, not just me, then, Kevin.
And Matt Deegan has asked me to mention on this podcast that you can now, just as a listener to any podcast, not just this one, vote. So there's a sort of public listeners category for, as it were, my favourite podcast. So I'm not saying that you have to go on to whatever the website is. I haven't even written it down. And vote for this podcast, but you can. You'd be very welcome to do that.
BritishPodAwards.com.
BritishPodAwards.com, is it?
PodcastAwards.com. I'll check it.
Pick of the pods. I'll tell you what, I'll put it in at the end by cutting it in now.
I think you'll find it's BritishPodcastAwards.com, and to vote for a podcast, go to BritishPodcastAwards.com/vote.
That sounded pretty good, didn't it?
Nicely done.
A real producer tells me that. Courtesy of Jazz FM, we are conducting the fifth monthly Radio Today Roundtable with Brett Spencer and Kelly Weil and Phil Maguire. And this is my favourite bit. We're going to find out what we've all been listening to. I think we should go ladies first.
So, I was going to talk about the fantastic sport content on Five Live that I'm an avid listener to. Am I probably the only one who's going to pick sport out of the panel today? But I've changed my mind.
Disappointment. which were you going to say, by the way?
Pick more than one thing.
Yeah,
I've got three.
No, just generally around football. I think the range of football-based programmes you get on Five Live now over the weekend is brilliant. I think they've got the best sports journalists.
You like 606, do you?
I love 606 now. I know it's been through a few changes over the past of it. I think they've got it spot on now with the best pairings on Saturday and Sunday. I think it's great.
Well
great
done,
radio.
Simon Cross.
I think it's that sweet combination of really good football discussion and accessible kind of good humoured chat. I think they've got it spot on.
You know what, Bobby? I seen you in your pink suit walking down Wrexham High Street and I thought, you know what? I don't like this lad, but I agree with you there.
Oh, it's a perception. I personally felt that if he was going to get a full-blown stamp on his head, he would have
Does it make a difference
stamping.
If it's a full-blown stamp or half a stamp?
No, it does. It doesn't.
Exactly.
No, exactly. But the thing is, I think if he was intended to it, I think he wouldn't have got as hardly the contact that he did
get.
And
do you know what? Andy, do you know what, and Chris? So, yeah. And I said this in the trail. As a former player, right, and you can take this either way you want. Yeah. If I'm Zlatan and I'm lying on the floor, yeah, and I believe myself that Mings stood on my head, intentionally or not, whichever way he thought, and then obviously you'd be absolutely raging, and as a player, you'd be thinking, right, next opportunity I get, personally, for me, and I'm talking about myself here, I would love to go and smash somebody. And
however, I listen to it every Tuesday. I get up really early and catch the 6:53 train from Wakefield to London. So something that cheers me up every single week and I download it is The Verb on Radio 3.
Ian McMillan.
It's just I constantly find myself fascinated by things that I didn't even think I'd be interested in. I suppose that's what a great piece of audio does, isn't it? Hooks you in. And the episode I listened to this morning was the most recent one, all about the relationship between dance and movement and words and poetry. And if I'd have thought I was going to find myself, you know, Googling the poetic French language of dance and how a choreographer's script is written down and the notation of dance, and it's just brilliant. And I think it consistently makes a 45 minutes of brilliant audio.
Scott, you've worked with choreographers, and I'm interested in how a dance is constructed by a choreographer. So, in other words, is there a written script? Is there something that's almost like a piece of Nathan's work that are just patterns of language? Is it maybe just orally transmitted? What's a choreographer's script look like?
Well, the way I've worked has been more with a dancer choreographer where we've been devising together, but she's sort of taken actually fragments of language from me, poetic language, and gone away and made a phrase. And she's just made that phrase and remembered it in her body. So
she's taking your language phrase and made a dance phrase.
Yeah. This is the interesting term that shifts between poetry and dance. So a phrase in dance, I understand as a sequence of movements. And obviously it has that grammatical function in poetry.
So I'm guessing you're not a natural Radio 3 listener.
I'm not, but it makes me switch Radio 3 on. So I suppose that those kind of programmes, that's what they're meant to do, isn't it?
It feeds in, I think, to what you were saying, Phil, earlier before we switched on, about how your listening has moved from live radio to podcasts, because I listen to The Verb, but I don't listen to Radio 3.
Yeah.
But I suppose I think of it as a podcast.
I listen to a lot of radio. I'm a listener, and it used to be 90% linear, mostly Radio 4. And these days, it's 90% podcasts, mostly American stuff. But I'm going to suggest a Radio 3 programme that you can listen to as a podcast as well. It's a Radio 3 Between the Years. It's produced by Falling Tree. Alan Hall, Eleanor McDowell and Hannah Walker-Brown are knocking it out of the park at the moment. Shortcuts, one of the best programmes on the radio, I think. But The Enemy Within, Radio 3, Between the Years, about PTSD. A phenomenally produced programme, really powerful and emotional. There's no presenter. The sound and the music is beautiful. And it's the voices of mainly the wives of people that have come back from a war zone with PTSD. Diary pieces, just them talking powerfully and emotionally about the impact of their partner's PTSD on them and their families.
In the night, she jitters, and I feel the jitters. Her legs start to kick out, her elbows start moving, her head, she twitches. It's almost like she's itchy inside. I hear a breathing change. It gets quite ragged. She'll go like she's scared. Do you know when you sleep and maybe you can feel a train through the wall? It's like that, constantly shaking. But when she's in a flashback, she's still. And then she runs.
We'll finish with Brett, but on the subject of the influence of American podcasts, I've been listening to a thing called Intrigue, which is made by Carrie Gracie, the BBC's China correspondent. And it's being done in a serial style. So Carrie's playing the role of Sarah Koenig. And it feels to me like the BBC doing a KTEL version of something that's been done rather better somewhere else. I am enjoying it and I want to find out what happens, but I think the most interesting thing about it is the fact that it's being done, and it is that American podcast styly that's being absorbed into the BBC.
Having read and listened to a lot of American podcasts, one thing that I know about the ones that are very well produced, the 99% Invisible, Radiolab, This American Life, is how much work goes into each episode, how many people read the script, how many redrafts there are. And I think Intrigue is an interesting go at that. But there are lines in the script and I'm just listening to them screaming at my podcast machine. How did that not get cut? How did that line stay in there?
And to understand what happened next, we need to know more about this incredible city of 30 million set in the steep hills of southwest China. Mobsters, money, guns, gambling, prostitutes, and corrupt politicians. Like Chicago in the 1930s, Chongqing is legend. It became the backdrop for this story that would change China. And in charge? The equally legendary Bo Xilai.
Hey, Alexa. How did that line stay in there? Brett Spencer.
Well, your picks are all a bit too upmarket for me. I'm going to take us down market. The thing I'm listening to on my morning commute is actually a TV show reversioned as a radio podcast, which is The Lead with Jake Tapper, which is on CNN in the US, but isn't broadcast over here by CNN International. Shame on them. And he, if you don't know who Jake is, he's kind of like Jeremy Paxman. He's a really tough interviewer. He was the guy that asked Donald Trump the same question 23 times last year during an interview.
And, well, that worked.
And yeah. And you can download that each morning. I'm listening to that on my morning commute, sort of a wrap-up of what's going on in Washington, which is fascinating.
Now, it would be bad enough if the president valued the conjecture and accusations of these sources more than the facts that he has access to more than any other person in the world. But it's actually worse than that. President Trump took what Levin and others were saying and made it even less tethered to fact. With conjecture and venom, they alleged a conspiracy. He took it one step further and said it happened and President Obama was behind it. And as we've reported, the FBI director is incredulous at this charge and says it's completely false.
Well, even lighter note, I'm enjoying Alice Levine on Radio 1, which I think is sounding really creatively fresh at the moment. It's the only thing I listen to with my kids. The rest of the time we're fighting over the dial, and they will quote bits of the show back later that day. And I never thought there'd be a time where I listened to something other than football on a Saturday afternoon. But that's a really fun show on Radio 1.
It's with one particular person, and we were talking about a site that she likes to use where your first date with somebody is to go on holiday. Which is quite a big thing, quite a different thing. If you're on the swipey apps, you might go for a drink, you might go for dinner, but to go to an exotic location on holiday as your first date, it's quite extreme. So it raised some interesting questions, which I felt I should put to her.
People are suspicious of romance and money changing hands, aren't they?
Oh, right, OK.
Do you see what I mean? Do you see what I mean?
Ah, did you hear how long that pause was? Did you hear how long it was? And also, really zoom in on how long it takes for her to reply and then my really, really uncomfortable laugh at the end.
People are suspicious of romance and money changing hands, aren't they?
Oh, right, OK.
Do you see what I mean? Do you see what I mean? Do you see what I mean?
If you watch the documentary, that's where I would screen grab the expression on her face that she gives me when I ask that question. Levine on Love on the BBC iPlayer. If you are
the other thing I wanted to mention, which really moved me this week, was the Irishman Abroad podcast. This has been going for quite a while. It's presented by a comedian called Jarlath Reagan, and he interviews Irish politicians and celebrities and sports stars. And it's kind of an interview format show, as you would expect. And on the show a couple of weeks ago, he documented his journey to the United States to donate his brother a kidney. And it's an incredibly moving programme. He asks all the sort of questions any of us would ask if we were asked to donate an organ like that. And then the operation takes place. And I'm cracking up now just talking about it. And you won't get past the 52-minute mark without crying. It's incredibly moving.
Hello there. I am speaking to you from the other side of this experience. And, you know, I can't breathe too deeply at the moment because there's a certain amount of pain, but I'll tell you this. The transplant took place successfully yesterday, February 2nd, 2017. We were both prepped, me and my brother, side by side, and we bumped knuckles, and it happened thanks to the wonders of anesthesia. It felt like it was over in a split second. Dr. George Chow removed my kidney. It was rinsed and it was placed in a preserving fluid and then quickly transplanted by another surgeon in the theatre next door into my brother Adrian. I'm told that once it was attached, it immediately oxygenated and started working there and then in the theatre. Which just blows my mind right now even to say it. But once I woke up fully, I was informed that he had passed urine. And I'll tell you, that relief is immense.
it's one of the most affecting pieces of radio I've heard for some time. And I don't know Jarlath, but I messaged him before I came here and just said, how are you? How is your brother? And he said they're both doing extremely well. So I'd recommend that. It's The Irishman Abroad. It's the kidney episode from a few weeks ago. If you want something a bit lighter, this week's show is an interview with Gabriel Byrne.
Can I mention something else?
Yeah, of course you can. No, keep going forever. I'm very happy. I'm enjoying all your suggestions.
I was in bits.
So this is an American podcast. Surprise, surprise, that's been recommended to me by John Ryan, our friend from 2ZY. And it's a new podcast by the US filmmaker Dan Taberski. And I've never heard of him. And until this podcast, I'd never heard of the fitness guru Richard Simmons.
Oh, yes, who looks exactly like Leo Sayer.
Well, he does look rather like Leo Sayer, right. And he went missing. He's called Missing Richard Simmons. And Richard Simmons was one of the most accessible, flamboyant celebrities in the world. He was out there all the time. And every day he ran a fitness class, as well as being worth millions of pounds after releasing many fitness videos. He still ran a daily fitness class. And then in 2014, he just closed the doors. He disappeared. He stopped doing public appearances. He closed all his friends down, all of the relationships he had. And he disappeared. He didn't die and he's not missing. He just disappeared from public life and from all of his personal relationships. And Dan Taberski was one of his friends. And Dan's decided to make a podcast about finding Richard Simmons. And I think there are some ethical questions. It's a great listen. It's very interesting. It's intriguing. It's really well produced. But is the best way to express concern about a friend's well-being to create a podcast about them going missing and hiding away? And there's an interesting article in the Rolling Stone magazine that asks just that question.
Richard Simmons lives right here on the left-hand side. His mailbox matches the front of the home, which is awesome. I love that.
It is pretty awesome. A tiny little version of Richard's ginormous home. He loves to tell people his house was featured as a plantation house stand-in in the opening credits of Gone with the Wind, but I'm going to call bullshit on that one. It looks like it could be true, though. Big columns, intricate topiaries. In fact, the only thing that doesn't look antebellum South are the two giant statues of Dalmatians flanking the steps. There is, however, one new feature, something that wasn't there the last time I was here. A brand new 6-foot fence between the world and Richard's front door. David hasn't seen Richard in over 3 years.
You know, I miss the days when I would pull up and he would be at the top window and he would roll it up. He'd roll up the window and wave down and yell down. He'd say, "I'm coming, guys, hang on." And then we'll just sit here and wait for him.
That's so crazy.
Yeah. And let me tell you, some of the outfits that he'd come outside in are hilarious. There was one that dressed like a bird. He had like feathers and everything. I can't even describe it. I would have to draw it.
David tells of this one time he realized just how far Richard would go for a little FaceTime. There's actually video of it. A passenger captured the whole thing on their phone.
That recipe is not from Louisiana. You come outside, we'll get outside. Anyway.
That voice in the recording, that's Richard.
If you're one of my students at Salford listening to this, that doesn't mean you can't fill in your ethics form, by the way. Brilliant stuff. Thank you ever so much. Any more addenda? Or shall we
Wind Up Now? Country on air on Thursday, midday.
Oof, looking forward to that. Radio 2 folk to come. Radio 2 reggae, surely a matter of time. Anything else from you, Cully?
No, onwards.
And upwards, Phil.
Any other business from me? At Charles Parker Day 2017, the Charles Parker Archive Trust, fantastic charity that runs the Charles Parker Prize, a prize for student radio documentary makers, student radio feature makers, and runs the Charles Parker Day every year. This time, it's on Friday the 7th of April in Sheffield. We'll be celebrating 50 years of local radio. We'll be talking about features and documentaries in the early days and examining the Asian radio scene in the UK. And I believe you're going to be there, Trevor.
I'm speaking. Quite what about? I'll have to decide. And you're producing, I think, aren't you, Kelly? Aren't you doing something there?
I'm not sure, but we produced many modern episodes of the Radio Ballads for Radio 2, which obviously Charles Parker made with you and McCall and Peggy Seeger, late 50s, early 60s. So over the years, we have been involved at some
capacity.
I think
John Tams and John Leonard are going to be there.
They very well might be. Yeah. And it's so, just 2 days after our Folk Awards event at the Royal Albert Hall, so we'll be a bit...
That's always a highlight of your year.
It certainly is.
Excellent stuff. Well, thank you very much indeed to Jazz FM for hosting our roundtable. Thank you, Phil Maguire and Kelly Weil and Brett Spencer. We shall be back with some radio moments from David Lloyd after the news. Here is Stuart Clarkson.
Yes, thank you, Trevor. And here are this week's top stories from radiotoday.co.uk. Three stations were in trouble with Ofcom this week. Scarborough-based DAB station Coast and Country for a presenter using the F word, Radio Sangam in Huddersfield for not logging its output, and student station Cam FM in Cambridge for not having any locally made programmes for a period that was monitored by the regulator. Scott Mills, Tony Blackman and Christian O'Connell are among the big names from the UK taking to the stage at Radio Days Europe later this month in Amsterdam. You'll be able to follow it all on Radio Today Live on Twitter, and of course we'll be there for the Radio Today programme to catch up with speakers and delegates. Alex Lester is back on overnight. He's making programmes for London digital station Thames Radio. He's on the schedule for midnight till 6, 7 nights a week. Alex recently left Radio 2 after more than 30 years there. He's taking over the BBC WM breakfast show from later this month. Nation Broadcasting has a new group programme director. Neil Greenslade moves up from mainly looking after programming on Nation Radio to overseeing it across the group's eight stations. And Ian Lee is on holiday this week, or is he on strike? He spent about an hour last week calling for other radio presenters to join him on a walkout in protest at radio becoming bland.
If you present a radio show, just think about the industry you are tacit in approving. Hashtag radio bland. Next week, I'm withdrawing my labour from radio for an entire week. I suggest you do the same. Ferrari, Ross, Hartley Brewer, the other people that work on this station whose names I don't know, Dale, O'Brien, Nocte, Glover. It's time to take radio back. Are you with me? Or again, me.
Looks from the schedule at Talk Radio, though, as if it was a planned holiday. And that's it for this week. More news, of course, every day at radiotoday.co.uk.
Thank you, Stuart. David Lloyd after this.
Broadcast Bionics brings you Phone Box, Oasis, Virtual Director, and many more innovative solutions for creative radio people. Come to bionics.co.uk and find out more.
Radio Moments. Radio.
It's 2 years this week since Zane Lowe's final show on Radio 1.
You know, to everyone who's worked on the show, listened to the show, all the artists who have given music to us to play on this show and given me an opportunity to do so, I want to say thank you very, very much. And I hope you enjoy, you know, I know you will enjoy listening to the wonderful Annie Mac this coming Monday from 7 p.m. Right, last song. This is the only one I've chosen tonight. Now, you could get emotional, or you could just shake it out. One band has been a constant for me throughout this whole journey. Give me more one-liners that I passed off as my own. Give me more great music than I could possibly hope to digest in a lifetime. And they've been kind to me too.
Zane Lowe, who of course made his way to the new radio world at Apple. I wonder whether John Peel would ever have been tempted there. This week, 49 years ago, he hosted his first ever Night Ride.
Well, it was a bit good, that. Rick Saunders had the occasional word ensemble, and that was called I'm So Glad. And I'm going to play a record now for everybody who's working at 22 Betterton Street, WC2. And it's a record I got yesterday from one of my favourite record shops, and it's very hard to get hold of, so they tell me. It's by Robert Wilkins, and it was recorded in 1930 in Memphis. And blues purists and people are going to, you know, be very upset if I say this, but it sounds like a sort of Mississippi Delta George Formby, which sounds, you know, it sounds very insulting. But it's such a lovely sort of happy sound. Thank you. And it's called Police Sergeant Blues, and it's really great. Listen closely to it.
That's how to sell in new music, isn't it? John Peel making friends with the late-night BBC radio on which his reputation was to be built. As Scotland prepares for its own BBC TV channel, let's remember that this week, 94 years ago, radio came to Scotland with the first broadcast from 5SC in Glasgow. Kath here was Auntie Cyclone.
We just went out and bought music every day for the programmes, brought it in, put fairy tale books on the piano and seized a book and just read. Well, I saw that the things were suitable, of course. I had a wee look at them beforehand. But everything was just done on the spur of the moment. I think there weren't any rehearsals just to begin with.
Thank you, Kath. Staying with Scotland, happy birthday to Richard Park. He's 69 this week. Richard is now the sharp-suited global radio executive, but he started out on air. He worked briefly at Radio 1, but his first radio work experience was on board the pirate ship Radio Scotland.
What this one make me sound cool. Actually, I remember Buddy Holly singing that one without actually too much equipment going from a London Palladium show back in 1958. One of Buddy Holly's greatest hits, perhaps in my opinion even his greatest. Buddy Holly that time and Ray Vaughan. Backtrack time just coming up now to 10 minutes past 5 o'clock on Radio
Richard Scotland. Park. He was also heard, of course, on Clyde too.
Yeah, I think the money will come through in the end, as I'm sure you do as well. Let's just rattle down the card for tomorrow afternoon. Some predictions, please, you. Aberdeen against St Mirren. Well, it's horses.
Happy birthday, Richard Park, undeniably one of British radio's top programmers. This week, 41 years ago, Reading got its commercial radio as Thames Valley Broadcasting, or Radio 210, was born. It claimed to be the only easy-listening independent local radio station. It was based in the old headquarters of Berkshire Civil Defence, launched with £220,000 investment, with News International owning 45%.
6:12 and a half. Today is our opening day of Radio 210 Thames Valley, ladies and gentlemen, and we've got an array of stars coming in to the station and also visiting the Butt Centre. Well, we'll be telling you a little bit about them later on, except to say that some of the big names are Mary Hopkin, the Surprise Sisters, Mac and Katie Cassoon, Gary Benson, Roger Whittaker, the Kersell Flyers. We've got June Ritchie, Polly Brown, Peter Skellen. I think we've got Mudd coming in, and Madeline Bell's joining me on the breakfast show this morning. So there we are. Stay tuned, because we're going to bring you the best and brightest in radio.
Quite a shopping list. Radio 210 to be the home of Mike Reed and Steve Wright as well. The station was named after its AM wavelength, later becoming 210 FM later in its life, when few people were by then bothering to turn to medium wave, a bit like the Carphone Warehouse, no longer selling car phones.
Gentlemen, wherever you happen to be listening right now, we'd like you to give us a call, particularly if you're outside our area or just inside the area, because we'd like to know where we're being received, all right? Give us a call now.
The station lost its name after 33 years. It's now Heart. Now, streaming radio stations is now commonplace, but this week, just 12 years ago, the original Virgin 1215 became the first station to allow anyone to listen anywhere on their phone.
Radio on mobile phones just got better. A new technology now enables you to tune in to radio stations outside of your local
one. It didn't actually just work with 3G, it worked on old-fashioned GPRS phones as well. The stream that it was connected to was 8K, so you can imagine how great that must have sounded. It ran on a couple of Nokia phones and a couple of Sony Ericsson phones, and there was a very complicated way that you had to download and install it. But it ended up working fairly well. One of the difficulties with it was that phones didn't have Wi-Fi on them, so you had to use your cellular data, and mobile data at that point was really expensive, like really expensive.
James Cridland. DLT was a familiar name in radio.
Whack, whack, oops.
And this week, 15 years ago, saw the final DLT show on Classic Gold.
Rusty Springboard, where does our love lie? In the middle of nowhere. Where else? This is Classic Gold, the place where we play you the songs that you can sing along to. And indeed you do, because you don't know this, but we have feedback. It's automatic here in the studio. We can just choose any street.
DLT, who was also the third presenter, of course, on Radio 1's breakfast show. And now, this week's 50 years ago spot, as we reflect on the significance of 1967 to radio. This week, that year, the Postmaster General, who was in charge of broadcasting matters back then, because he controlled what transmitters you were allowed to switch on, he announced the names of the first three BBC local radio stations. There were to be Leicester, Liverpool and Sheffield. Leicester was to be first because the local council was chipping in on running costs and even on the capital expenditure as well. Manchester had been proposed, but the local authority wasn't going to cough up any cash. The stations cost £55,000 a year to run. They were capitalised at £30,000. 2014 now, and Jack was no more in the home counties.
In February 2014, because of a dispute with the owners of the Jack name, listeners decided to change the name of the radio station.
Hundreds of new names were suggested.
Today, the 10th of March 2014, a new radio station is born.
Welcome to Bob FM.
Bob.
FM.
The perils of licensing a brand name. It's not really yours. Bob. So with the birth of radio jingles 66 years ago as the PAMS company was launched...
That's just our KY way of saying we love you.
Les Ross leaving BRMB FM for the new Extra AM 28 years ago.
I mean, if I read this as it's typed long enough, they're going to do something about the typist.
Most Housewives of... Choice, launched on the Light programme 71 years ago.
And round the corner I am, good morning.
The death of Adrian Love, 18 years ago.
Sometimes a call will come in and I can look around the studio and it's wonderful because you can see the eyes, all the eyes go together.
And Tim Davey, greeted by George Entwistle and Helen Bowden through a hole in the wall 5 years ago as new and old broadcasting house were linked for the first time. Those are this week's Radio Moments.
This week in history, Radio Moments.
Our thanks to David Lloyd, Stu Clarkson, our roundtable panel, Jazz FM for hosting us, and to Matt Deegan for being our mystery voice. Next week we'll catch up with Anthony Davis, well known from LBC and Smooth Radio, now establishing himself in Los Angeles. This has been a TDC production. Thanks for listening.
The Radio Today programme with Broadcast Bionics, creating and distributing clever software for radio.